Alright, time for another DraftPhysics.com video presentation. So, you can't really talk about kinetic energy without it being confused, okay, with the word potential energy, and some idea that things actually have potential energy, and so I guess what I want to point out is energy only comes in two forms. It's either streaming somewhere. That is, the pressure is going from A to B, it's moving in space, or it's trapped. That is, it's going back and forth, stuck inside of something, or it's in a cul-de-sac, and, you know, it's just spinning around in circles. So the only two forms of energy, all the forms of energy are always kinetic. It's just that you've either trapped the energy, okay, or else you're actively moving the energy from one place to another. So, and this has to do with springs and how they function, so I thought I would get to it through this description. So you can sort of, I have argued clearly that gravity is energy streaming. It's a stream of energy that, you know, is hitting the Earth. There's more coming down than comes back out of the Earth because the Earth is busy moving little bits. And by the little bits moving, it's using up energy to push the little bits of matter. So as the little bits of matter moves around, it's absorbing the energy that came in, is wasting time pushing matter instead of reflecting. So it's absorbing energy and producing what is a pretty hot Earth. Frankly, the center is very hot. Anyway, so it's a stream of energy. And you're just saying, well, how can I tap the energy in the stream? Well, if you're moving in the stream, you can't do anything. Okay, so if you're going with the stream, you can't catch the stream. You know, and yes, you can put something in the stream and it'll go down and you can catch that piece of energy, but you have to go against the stream because the stream's hitting you to lift the object to have it fall down. So you can't gain anything. Gee, that's not very clear. This position is always so difficult. Try this. Should have drawn it bigger, I guess. That's a little U here. All right, so the idea is that, yes, we can take advantage of the fact that there's some other mechanism at work, convention, you know, convection on Earth, and it's moving water up, okay, and then the water falls down, and we, okay, can just stick buckets in the down part, the waterfall, so to speak, and constantly have a perpetual source of energy as long as the system keeps pushing the water up for us. The heat keeps pushing the water up, and we can keep taking advantage of the water flowing to the surface, the lowest surface it can find. And so that works pretty good. But nothing had potential energy. The water droplets don't have any energy, okay? They have to be in the stream to have energy. They have to start falling. They have to start being pushed by gravity. So gravity's the source of the energy. There's no potential in the thing that falls. There's no potential energy in you when you're in gravity. If I put you 10 feet off the Earth, you don't have potential. The stream will push you if I let you go. So if I'm holding you by some rope tied to a rock in the stream, yeah, you'll just sit there, okay? But you're in the stream, but you don't have some potential energy. You're not full of potential. The stream has the potential. The stream is the thing doing the work, and it's kinetic. It's not potential energy. It's clearly very kinetic energy. It's moving. All right, and so the difference would be is then, say you're storing energy in a battery or you're storing it in some kind of other object. So a water tank, I don't know, you know, technically, what do we call that? You know, if you put the water in the tank, it's potential energy, but again, you're taking advantage of the fact that the gravity's creating the stream that'll make the water fall. Well, anyway, so you can say that an atom has a certain amount of pressure you can store inside of its little elements. So the conflict between its electrons and protons creates an opportunity for you to add more pressure, you know, put more stuff into it, in terms of the stuff, ping pong balls, let's say, bouncing between things. You can add more of them, or you can compress them and create more interactions and more pressure on the inside of the atom. So you can pressurize atoms and change, you know, so you go from one atom to another atom and it changes how much pressure that atom is under. And so they have a different quotient of energy because they have a different relationship between the electrons and the protons and the distance between them, which is going to sort of define their pressure. And so we can take advantage of taking a piece of chemistry that has, you know, a compound or substance that captures more energy as a collective. So when it's together, it's under higher pressure than when it's in some other form. And we can convert, you know, one atom into a different atom, or one compound into a different compound, and release part of the pressure, all right? And then we can remake it by putting pressure back in, okay, to reform. And so we can take advantage of chemistry in the sense we can store energy in one chemical, and through the changing the chemistry back again, we can release the energy we stored. So it's a battery, yeah. And then a battery is a battery. A battery is doing the same thing. It's just chemistry, right? In 99% of cases. You know, you could argue that you could make a flywheel, a very heavy object. You could put a lot of energy into it to turn it, all right? And if you can keep the friction as low as possible, you can store the energy temporarily, for a little while anyway, in the flywheel, in the motion of the object. And then you could just take off energy as you want it, from the fact that you've given mass motion and, you know, take advantage of it. But it's clearly kinetic. It's clearly not potential energy. It's a kinetic spinning wheel. So it's wrong to call it potential energy. It's stored energy. So, you know, I don't know what rule semantically to use, but I mean, it should be clear the difference between tapping a source of energy that's already in the, like gravity, as a flowing source, an active source, and you know, mechanisms where you're really hiding, okay, the same action, it's just inside of atoms and you can't see it, but it's all storage, really. I mean, it's all active kinetic energy. The energy is always moving in the universe. It's always an active force. It's never a potential force. It's always an active force, and you're really just talking about releasing it. You know, releasing or tapping it, which means you take yourself out of the source, like you stand on a rock in the stream, and then you can put a paddle wheel in there and, you know, take advantage of the stream because you're secured, not flowing in the stream anymore. If you're going with the stream, you can't take advantage of it, obviously. All right, that's probably enough for part one. Yeah, it should be back. All right, so this part's draft, all right, but it's the basic thing I want to talk about some anyway is the idea of a velocity. Like, you give something velocity on a pond, for example, and it only has a certain amount of energy. If it hits something, okay, whatever it hits, it's going to give motion to, it has to give away what it has. So any velocity that this stuff gets, it has to take from the object that moved it because there's no new source of energy. Versus the stream analogy, where something's you're constantly pushing. So that's sort of the gravity analogy, where you have the same velocity. But the fact is that velocity is sustained and maintained, because you're in a stream and it'll constantly refill whatever you give away. Okay, so this is the difference between impulse, something that has a certain amount of energy and that's all it has, and something that has an endless source of energy. Okay, it can just keep maintaining its velocity, its pressure that it can apply. So it can apply pressure for an hour, 10 hours, or a million hours, where this can only apply pressure for a certain amount of time, depending on how fast it's giving away its pressure. All right, so springs. So if I hit an object into a spring, and let's say the spring is very light, okay, you know, and it, I have a one mass and one velocity, whatever, it doesn't matter. The idea is the spring is going to leave, okay? It's not, it's going to get hit. It's going to absorb some energy based on its mass and a velocity. Now, the question is the velocity twice, you know, 2x this velocity? All right, because it's going to compress the spring first. It's going to hit this little piece, and this little piece is going to move, you know, especially if it's a loose spring. So the example would be like a slinky. You lay a slinky on the ground, plow a weight into it, and see how the energy moves through the slinky. You know, I mean, you know, that kind of thing. A loose spring versus a tight spring. So you can understand that a stiff spring is probably just going to get a little tiny bit of impulse here, and it's going to get transferred to here very quickly, and the whole spring is just going to leave. But the point is when you're compressing it, there's a point where it stops compressing and you're now pushing the spring. So the center of the spring's mass will start to move. So you're giving it velocity from the center of the mass moving, and you're going to store some velocity in the sense that you've compressed it a little. It's going to push back, so to speak, and that'll give it another velocity. So that might explain why you would have the expectation that would leave it twice the velocity. But now if I do a one mass on this side of the spring and a one mass on the other side of the spring, okay, even without the spring, you know, we have this idea that all the energy that this has will just be transferred to this through the spring. So the spring will compress, the compression wave, okay, the knowledge of the compression will move through the spring. I don't know, see, it'd be nice to see, that's the slow motion thing, it'd be nice to see as they take a semi-loose spring and hit it, and then you get to watch the spring compress and then push the other object at the same velocity this had. So all the energy gets into the spring compresses, the compression moves, it hits this object leaves at the same velocity this started with, because the mass is the same. And so what I guess I'm arguing is that if I change this to a two mass, all right, I can't make more energy. I mean, I can't make more mass and velocity moving. That's just, you know, in my opinion, too silly an idea. And so what's the transfer going to be like in terms of how much energy can this give this, because they're not the same mass, and what's the difference? And I guess the difference would be is when this compression moves through the spring, all right, it's it can't get all of its energy into the heavier mass, all right, and so there's some expectation that some portion of the energy will remain, will reflect off of the two mass. I mean, we really want to get to a point where we're comparing what happens if I have a infinite mass here, you know, something that won't move at all. Then you know that whatever energy you put in, you're going to get back out this way. Now, because of the way they've arranged their theory, they're going to argue that you have 2x the energy still in this object. So somehow it's always 2x the amount of energy is in the other direction, and you're going to, you know, count this, the getting the 100 back, let's say you start with 100, getting the 100 back is somehow because you had 200 in the other direction, and you subtract, you know, 100, well, that still wouldn't make sense. If you have 200 in this direction, oh yeah, you still have 100 going this way. Okay, yeah, so you subtract 100 going this way, and you still have 100 going that way, which you started with, which, you know, doesn't make any logical sense, because it's clear that you're getting the energy back in this direction. So you've changed the direction of the energy, but you haven't made 300 momentums worth of energy, you know, to do your subtraction and your minusing. It's clear you're getting back, you're just getting everything back as a reflection. So the energy went into the object, you turned and came back out. You know, that's the clear implication. You're getting what you put in, because this is not going to move. It's going to have to reflect the energy, because it can't absorb it, it can't use it. All right, so from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5, as you make this object heavier, there's some percentages. Now, in some experiments, it's clear that just like in this circumstance, you can get all the energy from the one mass into the two mass, and it just really depends on how stiff the spring is. So if the spring is stiff enough, then you'll get, you can get 99% or whatever. A large percentage of the energy will just travel through the spring, go right into the two mass. But the heavier you make it, the more likely it is the energy can't get in, okay, and that you'll get a reflection back. And maybe that just has to do with how long it takes this object to move. So we know that it moves faster. So if it's this size, if it's one mass, it's going to move faster. So it's going to be able to absorb the energy quickly. We know the heavier it is, the slower it's going to move. And that is, the more likely it is that some of the energy is going to start bouncing off the surface, okay, because the surface isn't moving. So the less the surface moves, the more of the energy reflects, and so that would tend to be the tendency of what percentage will get into this object, because it can't make 100 here and 100 going back the opposite way. It can't create more momentum. It can only use the momentum that you start with. This is imperfect, but I mean, that's what, it'd be good to have a nice video of showing the springs, showing the compression, show how they compress, and show the key thing is this middle of the spring. What happens to the spring? How much of the spring actually moves the center of the spring? So the argument would be is the center of the spring actually moves when you get 100% transfer, and it doesn't move, the lower the amount of transfer you're getting. So if you're only transferring 90 or 80 or 60 or 50, and all of a sudden you get to this point where you transfer zero and you get all of the energy back in the opposite direction. But I would say that's what I'm arguing is the more coherent explanation than some explanation that says you start with 100 and somehow you have a total of 300 available, in any one of these circumstances, and that somehow you're creating, as if this could leave at 2/3 the velocity, for example, and have 160 momentum, okay, well, 130, and you only started with 100 here, and you have 30 going back this way. Anyway, as is been demonstrated, this is all sort of dependent on what you're using as a spring. The stiffer the spring, the more reflection. Is that it? The less reflection? Yeah, see, those are the points I'm just not sure of. It just changes how much will be reflected, because it changes how quickly the energy can get from one point to the other point, and how quickly it needs to get into the other object. So the stiffer the spring, the more of an obligation there is for the energy to get in quickly, because the spring is stiff. And so if the object isn't moving, more likely to get reflection. So I guess I would argue the stiffer the spring, the more likely it is you get reflection. And the less likely you are to get reflection, the looser it is. So if you use this slinky, some long spring, and you hit an object into it with velocity, you would watch the impulse go through the spring and get to the other side, and frankly, it would be more likely that it's not going to reflect, because it's going to be moving slow, because it's going to be moving the speed of the transmission through the material, and so there'll be plenty of time for this to absorb the energy, where if it's a very stiff spring, just a piece of bent metal or something, any compression is transferred very quickly and needs to get into the other object quickly. So I think that's the right theory, but just can't say for sure. So anyway, I got to do some more diagramming, find more experiments, playing with springs, and how they actually do the transferring. Because again, it is kind of curious that when you have no mass on the other side, the spring is just its mass, and it'll bounce off, I think, at twice the velocity, so I have to verify that. So it's like it's like having a ping pong, a billiard ball hits the ping pong ball, right? Now, according to a Professor Lewin video, the ping pong ball leaves with twice the velocity of the billiard ball. So that's sort of a ping pong ball is basically a spring. Okay, so it's basically just telling you that, well, if the ping pong ball does that, then a regular spring will do that. So if I just have a spring and I hit the spring, spring's on a string and I just hit it, the spring should leave with twice the velocity. And then when you get to the same mass on either side, then you just get 100% transfer, right? And then if I get heavier and heavier, if I'm all the way to infinitely heavy, okay, I just get all the energy back as a reflection, and none of the energy, the momentum, succeeds in moving the other object. Yeah, I think that's good enough. All right. Draft. Yeah. The logic I'm applying. Who knows what logic you're applying? Yeah, I can't understand it. If you're defending kinetic energy, I just don't see how there's any defense. But I don't see how there's any defense with the lever argument. And so, you know. But whatever. Yeah, maybe that's enough. Keep it short. So, incomplete video. To be completed in the future. And such. So, this has been a draftphysics.com video presentation and such.